Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, listeners to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and with me today is Justin Pike, who has recently, and maybe not so recently, become one of the most notable Twitter personalities with respect to discussion of the Pacific War. And so today, we're going to talk a little bit about how Twitter has sort of popularized and sort of democratized, in a sense, military history in some places. But then we're going to really dig into the meat of it. We're going to talk about China's role in World War II. We'll talk a little bit about what the best new books on the Pacific War are looking like at this moment. And then finally, and you're going to have to stay tuned for this, we're going to talk about battleships, which is everybody's favorite weapon for Lawyers, Guns, and Money. So I guess to start off with, Justin, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And it's nice to be on here.
Yeah, I'm actually, and for listeners, I am podcasting today from a backyard, and the chittering you hear in the background is an angry squirrel chittering at a dog. So don't be shocked. Justin, why don't you introduce yourself and sort of tell us how you found your way to this particular niche?
So I have an MA in history from the University of Calgary. It was awarded in 2016. Technically, it was in intelligence history. I worked under Dr. John Farris, who's quite well known in that sphere. He's actually writing the first official history of GCHQ, so the British Signals Intelligence Agency. And I wrote that on American intelligence assessments of Japanese air and naval power in the interwar period. And outside of that, of course, I have a broader interest in just the development of sea power and air power in the interwar years and the Asia-Pacific War in particular. And then I tend to focus on Japan, at least that Pacific region. I kind of stumbled into, I haven't been on Twitter that long, only probably 3 years. And originally, I kind of started inching, after I finished my MA, that was pretty much mentally going to be it for me. But I kind of got involved with some YouTube channels that are fairly popular, Military History Visualized, and later, a little later on, Military Aviation History, which kind of got me thinking about maybe if I love history so much, I'm doing all of this research and all that on my own anyway, why not talk about it somewhere? So I decided to maybe just fire up a Twitter, and now, I mean, at the moment, I've got about 2,000 followers, kind of small potatoes by Twitter standards, but it's getting up there.
Right. And you're followed, but you're followed by a lot of the serious historians who are on Twitter of the Pacific War, right? So, I mean, you are rubbing elbows with the people who are serious professional historians of the Pacific War.
Yeah. And it's an awesome experience. You know, Twitter can get a reputation for being a very volatile platform at times, but since I've laser focused so much on kind of this particular aspect of history and just getting to talk and like throw ideas out there and all of this with all of these people that are in academia that normally, you know, you'd read a book from them and never get to really interact with them in any way. And then on Twitter, you'll often get to see them maybe developing thoughts before it becomes an article or a book later on. And it's all very exciting. And then of course beyond that, just kind of talking about this stuff and bringing attention to it to an audience that normally wouldn't ever interact with academic history at all is kind of a very exciting prospect. So even talking about something that within academic circles is pretty standard understanding or anything like that, but in popular circles isn't. So there can be a lot of excitement just bringing that kind of stuff to a wider audience.
Right, right, and if I recollect correctly, I mean, I read your argument about the interwar. Did I get that from you? I can't remember now, but I think I wrote it up for The Diplomat. Your master's thesis itself was very interesting stuff, but then also sort of following you from then on out has been very interesting as well. And so, given the interest of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast listeners, I think we'll have a good experience today. So when we spoke earlier, we talked about sort of where are the big areas in which the historiography of the Pacific War has really begun to move forward and really turn up some interesting stuff. And so the first thing that you mentioned was bringing China back in. So what do you mean exactly by bringing China back into the story, writing China back into the story, to borrow a phrase from Hamilton, writing China back into the story of the Pacific War? Like what are the interesting works and like what are the big findings about bringing China back in?
Yeah, so this is my pick definitely for the most kind of exciting thing that's happened in the last, I'd say, maybe 20-ish years, which I guess in historiographical terms is relatively recent, particularly since there's always that time lag too between what's going on in academic circles versus popular understanding. And in the case of China, it's huge because for decades after the war, China was kind of, the role of China was minimized. If it was talked about in, particularly in English-speaking circles, it tended to be belittled or kind of dismissed. It was just an irrelevant footnote to the real war. And particularly, it was also caught up in a lot of Cold War politics, the whole who lost China, because, of course, it became mired in the Chinese Civil War and American involvement. So, for example, the Stillwell Affair, also Hans von de Ven, one of the great recent historians of China in World War II, kind of describes that very well. He described it as American historians for a very long time would view the war in China through the lens of the Stillwell Affair, with all of that baggage and those personalities that kind of skewed our perceptions. And of course, it didn't help on the other side that you had a dictatorship on the Chinese mainland that wasn't going to let people into archives or anything like that. You had a dictatorship on Taiwan that was pretty much very much the same thing all the way into the, and really it was locked down pretty tight all the way into the mid 70s when both Dai, Mao and Chiang Kai-shek. Then you start to see like a slow opening up. I don't want to get so wildly optimistic. I mean, there's still a lot that's not necessarily accessible, particularly on the mainland, but a surprising amount can be. And also some of the relaxing of restrictions on academics on the mainland as well, because this kind of started really in the Chinese language with Chinese historians, both on the mainland and on Taiwan. And then it would kind of started seeping out into some English stuff, really from the, I'd say maybe the 80s, but very small reach, like a journal article here or there. Kind of thing. I kind of like it as a nice starting point is Hans von de Ven's War and Nationalism, which came out in the early 2000s. And that's the book where he actually put out a call to other historians. He wanted them to break what he called the Stillwell White paradigm, which by that he means the narrative created by Stillwell and his acolytes and by another person, a journalist called Theodore White, who wrote a book, Thunder Out of China, that was published pretty much immediately after the war. And those two perspectives formed our understanding for decades. And then we've started this course correction over the last 20 years with first really recontextualizing nationalist China, because one thing about understanding China in World War II is that you have to understand China a bit further back than just 1937 to understand why China was fighting the war the way it was, why China had the limitations that it had, because that was one limitation of earlier works where they were Stillwell, stuff inspired by Stillwell specifically, because Stillwell would just hammer them. Oh, they're corrupt. They were all inept. They were they wouldn't fight, blah, 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 blah. And then Hans von de Ven and others have kind of contextualized, you know, why Chiang was worried about the things he was worried about. And also just correcting certain things, because the nationalist regime wasn't quite as corrupt and inept as had been previously represented. That's not to say that it wasn't, because there's, of course it was, but it had kind of been, it was just kind of a stump line for a long time in our understanding that that's how you summarize the war in China. They were corrupt, inept, and didn't fight. So why bother looking at it?
So to interrupt for just a second, so has, you may be getting to this, has our understanding of the comparative effectiveness of nationalist and communist forces changed as well, sort of in this reimagination? Because that was always one of the most deeply politicized issues, strangely enough from the American side too, of sort of evaluating China's role in the war.
Yeah, so it's almost reversed, because the old school line and the line that would be pushed by mainland China after or under Mao in particular is that communists did the bulk of the fighting. They were doing the real fighting. Nationalists were holding back for the civil war. That was kind of the gist. And Stilwell would play into that. And other American journalists during the war, they were kind of, because they'd be in Chongqing, and then they would see a lot of, ironically, because there was less repressive censorship and restrictions, they could see a lot more criticism of the government and problems. And then when they would get into, say, communist areas where it was far more repressive, they would get a nice little show and they'd be like, well, look at how wonderful this is. And that kind of carried forward echoes in the literature. It was, of course, reinforced by the mainland. And really the Republic of China on Taiwan didn't exactly they hadn't garnered a whole lot of goodwill on the part of. So when they're saying, no, we were fighting, people would just kind of hand wave that narrative because it didn't quite jibe with what American journalists and Stilwell and other people involved in the war at the time were saying. So yeah, in short, that it has kind of reversed, where logically, of course, the nationalists made up the vast majority of Chinese troops under arms for the entire period of the war. The communists made up a relatively small portion. It would grow through the war, but they were never a majority fighting. They launched one set piece offensive during the entire war, which failed. Beyond that, they did launch guerrilla operations, because you'll see kind of a counter argument too. It's like, well, the communists actually did nothing. Where, well, no, they were doing things, but less than the old narrative said. Exactly what they were doing in extreme detail, we still don't have a super firm picture, because that would involve a lot more. We need a lot more archival access and things like that. But they were fighting. The nationalists took on the lion's share of the war. And the nationalists were who the Japanese were laser fixated on for the entire conflict.
So, I mean, what can we say now? Sort of, I mean, you know, much of the story here has been that, or I've read a text in the 1990s, which, you know, effectively made the claim that that the China War was simply a wash for the Japanese, right? That they you know, funded and resourced the war largely from the territories that they had already conquered in China. And so it's not even really useful to think about China playing, the campaigns in China playing this role of even hamstringing the Japanese efforts in the Pacific. I mean, has that really changed in some ways too? Or, I mean, it seems especially where, you know, especially in the context of at least air power and the use of air power, that, I mean, we would have to say that the campaign in China had some sort of detrimental effect on Japan's ability to fight in the Pacific.
Yeah, so this is a point of discussion that I think is still being worked out in the newest literature. In a edited collection of essays called The Battle for China, there is actually one of the essays in there is talking about the connections between the Pacific War as, you know, we understand it in the West versus the war in China. And their general conclusion was the war in China was a significant drain on Japan, but they were careful not to overstate, as in the Japanese Navy is in the Pacific pretty much. The bulk of Japanese air power is drawn off into the Pacific once that war starts. The ground forces, there are a lot more ground forces left in China. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men. Sometimes, you know, at various points, it exceeds a million. Expenditures on that are pretty high within the budget. He actually lists a whole bunch of budgetary figures. I don't have them in front of me, but it's a considerable amount of money. Strategically, the Japanese army in particular kind of tends to focus on China longer than people would think. For example, in 1942, all these discussions of different strategic paths that the Japanese could have gone after their initial conquest. So do we attack Midway? Do we attack into the Indian Ocean again? Do we invade Australia? One of those, actually, that was being planned by the Japanese army was an operation to use the forces that had routed the Allies in Burma, plus the Chinese Expeditionary Army, or forces in China, to launch a major offensive exceeding about 300,000 men into Sichuan province to wipe out the nationalist regime. So that was one of those options. As it was eventually canceled, because what ended up happening is that the Guadalcanal campaign was dragging out and taking way more resources than the Japanese thought. And eventually it had drained so many resources. In fact, three of the divisions that would end up getting sucked off into the South Pacific had actually been earmarked originally for this operation in China. So there's connections like that. One thing that's often stated, that the one thing that China did in the broader war, is they locked down quite a few Japanese troops. That's true, and also a little bit misleading, because it's not like if they ended the war in China, they could just take, 800,000 men or whatever and then transplant them anywhere else in the empire that they needed. It may have freed up resources, but they had to move them around for one thing. And also China wasn't, even if they ended formal organized resistance, there was going to be major counterinsurgency needs.
Yeah, no, I mean, the logistical challenges of trying to shift as much of that portion to Southeast Asia and the Indian border would have been extraordinary, right? I mean, especially given the terrain in that area. And I mean, Japan was just broadly, by the time it engaged with the United States, it was just broadly uninterested in fighting the Soviet Union anymore, right? Until the Germans. So you can't even imagine necessarily this sort of refighting battles against the Red Army at this point while Japan was still at war with the United States.
Yeah, like there would always be advocates within the Imperial Army saying, eventually we can go fight the Soviet Union. But that's all it really remained, is a segment within the Imperial Army. The Navy, the Army, it's very bizarre. The Army always, not always, but early on, they considered that the war against the U.S. that they'd started was the Navy's problem. And they had to make do with what the Army had given them for the initial move south. And then with Guadalcanal, of course, like, it starts ramping up. Suddenly they're asking for more and more men. And they start to recognize through 1943 that, oh boy, this is like, we have to send a lot more. So the China theater starts becoming where they're pulling forces from. There's always this lobby within the Imperial Army, within particularly the Chinese Expeditionary Forces or force, that, okay, we should like do things in China, but usually they were pilfering the Chinese Expeditionary Force for operations in the South Pacific or wherever else they were needed. They were also started pulling units reluctantly out of the Guangdong Army in Manchuria, because a significant forces were left always eyeing the Soviets on the Manchurian border.
Is there, I mean, we are familiar with sort of the various mythologies, and I use the word mythology with a little bit of caution, but we know, for example, of how people in the Wehrmacht thought about the different fronts, right? About how what a transfer to the Stalingrad front meant, or transfers to other portions on the Eastern Front for particular soldiers. Were there narratives within the Imperial Japanese Army that were like that, right? Was it considered, nearly suicidal to be sent to Guadalcanal? Was there preference for service in China over different parts?
Yeah, that I can't comment on too strongly, other than I have seen a few scattered references to, of course, China was known as a little bit less, you'd rather go to China than you would somewhere in the South Pacific. Like Guadalcanal toward the end, it got the Japanese nickname kind of famously as Starvation Island, which is, it doesn't sound clever in English, but I had it explained to me by someone who's fluent in Japanese that it's actually a play on the kanji. So it's a play on words. Guadalcanal and Starvation Island are very similar in Japanese. So it didn't garner, and of course, New Guinea was undesirable. generally. So China would probably be a more desirable front there because it was considered a, like, I've read comments from, I think it was Sakai Saburo, and I've read another comment from someone else as well, that China was kind of the easy war, was the mindset. Because, I mean, even as late as with the Ichigo offensive in 1944, so it ran from about spring 1944 through to early 1945, they had overwhelming, at least tactical, operational success against the Chinese. One can debate the strategic merits of Ichigo. It was kind of a failure, like it didn't really accomplish much. But at least on the tactical level, if you're a soldier on the ground, if you're going to be somewhere in the Japanese Empire in 1944, you know, fighting in Ichigo is going to be better than, you know, dying in Burma, at, you know, in Fukushima, or fighting in the Pacific on any multitude of islands, you know, on the Marianas.
Right. That was actually that was about to be my next question. Was how close did the Ichigo offensive come to driving China from the war? How close did it come to sort of achieving its objectives? Now that with what we know now, right? I mean, the way that Ichigo is often portrayed in the older literature is, you know, that fighting China is always like punching jello. And then in 1944, the Japanese just punched harder and the jello went farther back. But it seems like now that we have a more sophisticated understanding, like how close did that come to really hurting the Chinese?
Okay, so to cover really quick, I guess for people that maybe aren't familiar, is the very earliest stages of the war in China will go from say July 37 up to maybe roughly like, let's say 38. Or even 39. Really, this is a period of actually rapid war maneuver, large-scale campaigns. And at this point, this is where, particularly in the Shanghai area, there's a huge battle around Shanghai in 1937, where Chiang commits a lot of his best Central Army forces. These are the German-trained elite formations. And it's a horrific fight, involves hundreds of thousands of men. Eventually, the Chinese lose, but there's like significant resistance here. And in fact, enough to actually really throw the Japanese off balance. And Chinese would still continue to resist tenaciously all the way through this early period of the war. And then eventually it settled into stalemate. The Japanese had pushed about as far inland as they could do so logistically and also do so against a Chinese resistance. The Chinese had thrown them back from Changsha, once they kind of got slapped around there. And there was a kind of a period of stalemate. There were still operations going on. Usually when the Japanese would launch an operation, it would generally succeed. There was a second battle of Changsha actually launched pretty much concurrently with the invasion of Hong Kong. And that was on the Japanese side, that was part of the same operational plan because they wanted to tie down Chinese forces so they couldn't relieve Hong Kong. For a long time, soldiers that fought the Hong Kong campaign, they thought that Chinese soldiers coming to their aid was just a myth or like something somebody had said. But in fact, there actually were plans and the Chinese did intend to try and relieve Hong Kong, but they got tied down in this other operation. They ended up pushing the Japanese back again from Changsha, which was a relatively minor victory, but it was actually among the Allies in the first few months of the war. It was one of the only... pretty much the only land victory the Allies had was a Chinese one, ironically. So if we fast forward all the way to Ichigo, by then, this is the eighth year of China's war. It's tired, it's worn out. Very little aid gets to China. They're largely cut off. You know, Burma's fallen. They can't. It's really difficult to get supplies in. And the army at this point, I mean, they've been ravaged by famines. By this point, corruption has accelerated to pretty bad levels. A lot of the Chinese units have been just completely hollowed out. And a lot of top Chinese leadership is quite aware of this. And when the Japanese hit it, the war zones, as the Chinese call them, they're kind of like army groups. A lot of them just disintegrate in front of the Japanese advance. And the Japanese, there's three kind of major objectives that the Japanese have with Ichigo. So there's to knock out Allied air bases. They do knock out several of them. To create a land bridge between their forces in Southeast Asia and Korea, basically, because they're at this point, of course, the submarine war is ramping up. They want to try to just maybe hop their supplies to Indochina or whatever, and then run it up land to Korea and then hop across to the home islands. That's their logic, of course. It's not really feasible without extensive railways and all that, but that's their logic. And the third kind of unspoken one, this is one that Edward Dre pointed out, but it often goes unmentioned, is that at least on the part of the officers within the China Expeditionary Force in China, they had a kind of an objective of, we're going to destroy the nationalist military and finally just end the war. So they managed to succeed in creating the land route that they then can't really use because they can't move enough stuff anyway. They do knock out some airfields, but not all of them. And of course, the fall of the Marianas makes that largely irrelevant anyway. And while they completely smash the nationalist army, it still somehow survives. And they don't take Chongqing. They don't take Sichuan province. Nationalist China is just barely still in the war. Hans von de Ven has argued that this was the closest that Japan came to like militarily knocking China out of the war. And he kind of portrays it as it was possible that had something gone differently, it might have knocked China out of the war.
Right. Although that by that point, even knocking China out of the war would simply have freed up Japanese troops for defending Japan, which I suppose they could have more effectively defended Manchuria from the Soviets, but it was no longer it would not have been strategically decisive in the broader war, right? Even forcing Xiong from the war would not have changed the Japanese calculus in August of 45.
Exactly. Like the China theater, even in this new historiography, I haven't seen anybody saying that actually, you know, the war was won in China or something like that. Very much, you know, when you look at what Japan has left on the table in, say, August 1945, they still have millions of men in the Imperial Army. A lot of them actually are pretty reasonable, well-equipped and experienced units. Some of them, the ones in China, are actually coming off the back of a series of victories, so they're not even really, like, being hammered. Yet, Japan loses because their navy's gone. What's left of it is sitting in port being bombed. Their air power is much diminished. I mean, they're holding back pretty much what they have left for the final defense of the home islands. And the U.S. has imposed and the British as well have imposed a complete air sea blockade of the home islands. It doesn't really matter what the million men in China really do by that point. There's nothing that they can really do to change the disastrous war situation in the Pacific.
So I want to bounce now. I know that we had listed, we talked about doing the surveys part second, but I think actually that would be best to do at the end. Let's bounce now because you brought up their main units surviving simply in port to an article that just came out in the Journal of Military History that you highlighted that I've had the chance to read by James Fitzsimmons. That is effectively claiming, and this is an awfully exciting claim, right, as you know, effectively claiming that, you know, that how we have thought about the balance between battleships and aircraft carriers, especially in the Pacific, is just fundamentally wrong, right? That battleships remained, and he almost ranges into not simply saying a key, but almost the key arbiters of naval power, even late in the war. I mean, I enjoyed this article immensely. I can't say that I agree with many key, or, you know, with the most leading claims in it. But I guess so you introduced it to me. So, what are your thoughts about this article?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'd say maybe about 70% of the article is pretty conventional as far as how people talk about the relationship between aircraft carriers and battleships, particularly interwar literature, which is what I'm most familiar with. I mean, my first exposure to, okay, it's not so self-evident that the aircraft carrier is going to supersede the battleship in 1920 was actually an edited collection that was published in 1977. So this concept has been going around for a long time. what he's doing is he's carrying it forward into the war, which he's not also not the first to do, because I'm aware of at least Robert Lundgren. He's a historian. He wrote a book that was something, I can't remember the title, but it has something like battleships. The central thesis is that the battleships were key to victory in the Pacific. And I know there's a little bit, there's other stuff floating out there as well that has made kind of some of these claims. And then James kind of combined all of that into one article. And then he's really pushing it in some areas. I mean, I guess his central point is that the battleship was still absolutely key to sea control. Just because of that a carrier force could not sink a major enemy task force of heavy surface ships on its own. And with the implication of defending, say, an amphibious landing from just a heavy surface force that was just going to go for them. And I don't know, I'm kind of conflicted about it. I've read it twice now, because I read it initially and then I reread it in advance of this. And I'm like, I'm still like going, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it accords with it's very interesting. It's very interesting, right? And it made me, for example, it made me read a lot more into the sinking of Repulse and Prince of Wales, right? Because as he correctly points out, you know, this has an enormous psychological effect on all sides in the war. But as he correctly points out, these are land-based bombers, right? And the consequence of them being land-based bombers is more significant than people tend to really want to look into, because they have much longer ranges than their carrier-based brethren. And they carry heavier ordnance, right? Especially the bombs, right? The bombs, which did significant damage to both Repulse and Prince of Wales and damaged the steering on both of them, if I recall correctly, were bombs that in some cases, especially the way they were employed, carrier aircraft simply couldn't carry. And that was very interesting. You know, there's also, I don't know if you're familiar with it's a David Fukuya article from, I think, the 1990s about the U.S. Navy essentially completely wasting its battle fleet force in the early years of the war by not being completely unwilling to commit it at all, which sort of feeds into, I mean, I suppose, so let's boil down to what the core of this argument is. Battleships were not invulnerable to carrier aircraft, but they were extremely resistant to them. This is something, battleships at sea on all theaters, including the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, were hard to sink with carrier aircraft. And generally speaking, you needed battleships to deter them. But it seems like a corollary of this argument is that all three, the Imperial Japanese Navy, the U.S. Navy, and the Royal Navy, were way too shy about how they used the battleships in the war, right? I mean, that seems almost a necessary conclusion that comes from this, right? That these naval professionals who had battleships and aircraft carriers at their disposal all made pretty tragic errors in how they used them between 42 and 44. And I that one I have a little trouble stomaching, because, you know, maybe one fleet makes systematic errors in that, but all three, the authorities in all three navies making systematic errors about how to use their most lethal assets, I find challenging. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of read on it. It there's a lot of pretty interesting good points in this article. And yeah, like I'd boil it down to basic, the three main ones is that air power, particularly carrier air power, was not completely, it didn't completely negate surface navies. In fact, surface navies properly employed with sufficient anti-aircraft had more than a sporting chance of dealing with an air attack. That's kind of one of his main points, and I don't think that's particularly controversial. Then his second point is that the battleships were far more useful. And that's the one where he's really pushing the lines. Up to a point, it's pretty conventional. Like, outside of popular circles, I haven't seen anybody straight-faced say that, oh, battleships were useless. Like, they didn't do anything. They had lots of purposes. And then kind of his third point that the battleship was like the absolute core like center of everything kind of like at some points, for example, one of his, he uses Midway as one example, as in after the Battle of Midway has been won, as in all four Japanese carriers have been sunk, and the heavy cruiser, what he argues is that while the Japanese could, they still had more than sufficient surface forces to just ram the invasion fleet through. The carriers, the American carriers, wouldn't have been able to stop it. I've been thinking about it. It's like, well, technically, yeah. It's just to what end? In the particular case of Midway, I mean, even setting aside the fact that the amphibious landing itself being successful is not a foregone conclusion, but I mean, the Americans are going to be attacking you with what aircraft they have left. They're going to do damage. And some of his examples, like there's more than that. Like some of his examples kind of follow that track of, okay, they could technically do this, but why? The other one was the Philippine Sea as well. He said that pretty much, I mean, the Japanese could have tried to ram through a surface attack on the amphibious fleet, which is slightly more engaging, I think, actually. So if the Japanese are just willing to throw away or risk their surface assets to maybe damage the American amphibious fleet, maybe they could have done it. His implication is that the Americans needed the battleships there to make sure that that didn't happen, to not contort his argument. But his main point is that the aircraft carriers alone couldn't prevent that from happening, which I'm still sitting on the fence about it.
Right. I mean, I think that sort of the case is better taken, right, if we sort of, I mean, if the Philippine Sea really doesn't strike me as a great way to sort of treat this particular argument, because there is a massive U.S. surface fleet right there. But, you know, I think we could take it so seriously as, you know, it is very possible that Yamato and Musashi were effectively unsinkable by carrier aircraft before 1944, right? It takes an enormous resources to sink Musashi in Sibuyan Sea at the Battle of Leyte Gulf, an immense resources to sink Yamato, right? And so I think we can, in a limited way, we can sort of take this and say, and this is, you know, this is also not a new insight, right, that the Japanese could have used their fast battleship force more effectively in the campaigns of 42 and 43. But I think that point is really sort of well taken, that, maybe they weren't invulnerable to carrier aircraft. They were kind of relatively invulnerable to the kind of carrier aircraft the U.S. and the amount of carrier aircraft the U.S. was able to put forward, you know, even in the first 2 years of the war. And yet the Japanese still didn't take advantage of that. And I think, I mean, I guess another thing that sort of occurred to me in the discussion of Leyte Gulf, and he doesn't really talk about this, but, you know, the carrier aircraft, they did inflict some pretty significant damage on a lot of those ships, a lot of Kurita's ships that were moving north. I mean, Yamato had taken damage, Nagato had taken damage, both of the Kongos had taken fairly significant damage before they ever engaged with the U.S. forces off Samar. And, you know, the carrier aircraft had made a tactical decision of focusing on one super battleship, and which they sank, right? And it's more than just like, you know, sinking a super battleship is like, it's more than just a single vessel, right? It's a single really incredibly important vessel. But they had also inflicted some pretty serious damage, and the aircraft that were being launched off Samar from the escort carriers also inflicted some fairly significant damage. It's one thing to say an admiral can simply push through all of these aircraft inflicting all of these damage and is probably going to, show up where they want to be with a ship that's still afloat. But that ship is going to have taken significant damage that will really affect its mission readiness and that may affect its ability to get home when it's done whatever it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one point that he brushes up against it, but he never really drives it home, is that he's talking about how difficult it is to sink surface ships, particularly battleships with aircraft, which, okay. And he doesn't quite hit it home of, well, I mean, you look at what aircraft carriers are doing to this battleship, but then the battleship is completely incapable of hitting back. he kind of leans up against it as in, okay, well, the battleship is going to go do something else. That maybe the carriers can't stop it from doing, which, okay, I think there's something there. But that's where it kind of, I feel it's a little bit falling short.
Right. I mean, there is no aircraft carrier other than the escort carriers. There is no aircraft carrier in the U.S. arsenal in the Pacific, which is as slow as Japan's fastest battleship. Right. I mean, you can never catch them. They can always run away as long as they're not HMS Glorious. Right. I mean, they're always going to be able to run away from the battleships, in part because they have better situational awareness than the battleships do.
One interesting example that he doesn't dig into it at all, it's a part of a broader point he makes that he's not the first, but I've seen it coming up more often now when people talk about the Japanese Navy, is that at times the Japanese Navy almost seem to be paralyzed by their fear of enemy air power. Like they had completely, so of course air power is very powerful, but they had blown it out of proportion to the point that perhaps they weren't making the best decisions. They were over-evaluating the possible end result. He mentions Coral Sea in passing, which is quite interesting because I've actually, a relatively new trilogy came out and it's dealing kind of with the South Pacific Air War in this very early part of the war, and it ends with the Coral Sea. And their argument in that is that, just from a measured assessment of what Allied air power was doing to the Japanese invasion force that was headed for Port Moresby, it had been in range of Allied air power for 3 days and they'd done absolutely no damage to it at all. The Japanese carriers had driven the American carriers from the area. They technically still had Zuikaku with enough aircraft function, although of course there's doctrinal considerations and issues there. But the argument of this trilogy was kind of like, the Japanese pulled back. They stole, or they grabbed a defeat from the jaws of victory. They had more than enough surface forces to deal with what was left of the Allied surface forces. Allied air power, even though it was there, was insufficient at dealing with the invasion force. So maybe they could have pushed there and taken Port Moresby. So I've seen this argument coming up from multiple corners a little bit, and it's quite interesting to see. I think in the case of Operation MO, there's a lot of merit there. Other parts, it starts kind of, it just doesn't sit 100% right with it.
Right. I mean, you know, sort of as you said earlier, okay, you can go ahead and take Midway. So what? Right. As long as the Americans still have aircraft carriers and you don't, it doesn't matter whether you've taken Midway or not. But that doesn't apply to Port Moresby, right? Port Moresby was going to be strategically useful to the Japanese under almost any imaginable circumstance of the war, right? No matter what happens in the battle. And so I've sort of long wondered that too. Like, why? Why did they pull back from that campaign at that point when it still seemed that they had a more than reasonable chance of winning the victory?
Yeah, and one part of it, I've skimmed the trilogy. I really want to sit down and read it cover to cover. But it kind of portrays a Fourth Fleet Command who's been overseeing all of these operations in the South Pacific. They kind of get burned a few times by various things, including air power, particularly Le Salamoa. And there's kind of this argument that they kind of started becoming really paranoid. And then the thought of pushing forward without air cover was just, it was too much for them. And at least as a few authors have started to argue that this was maybe wrong. They could have just pushed through the enemy air power, made their landing. That might have saved the Japanese. You know, I'm not going to say Japan goes on to win the war, but that completely changes the dynamic of the campaign on New Guinea, which ends up, the campaign on New Guinea is a very long, protracted, bloody campaign. It draws in a lot of Japanese effort. If Port Moresby falls to amphibious invasion early on, that's a lot of horrible fighting that doesn't happen, at least not in the way that it did historically.
Right. I mean, I suppose, and let's have this to wrap up the battleship conversation. I mean, the other part of this has to be that, you know, the major powers continued to build aircraft carriers during the war, all of them, and they stopped except for the United States, which could build as much of it as it wanted of anything that it wanted. Only really the United States continued to build battleships. Nobody really conceived of building battleships in a serious way after the war, except for the Russians, who then gave it up as soon as Stalin died. You know, the U.S. stopped building two almost complete battleships as soon as the guns fell silent. You know, the British looked at the idea of building the Lion class after the war and decided, nope, there's just no point to this. And yet they still built aircraft carriers. You know, and you can make the argument, okay, well, carrier aircraft are getting heavier and more lethal during this period. And so, you know, this is when the battleship truly becomes obsolete. But it still seems like quite a stretch to me to be making this argument about the battleships in 44 and 45.
Yeah, and he, and I can't comment as strongly on this post-war stuff. It's kind of like at the very end of his article, he kind of, I think it's only a couple paragraphs where it's almost, he kind of pushes like the argument that one of the main reasons why the battleship dies after the war is it really has less to do with the aircraft carrier and more to do with the development of reliable anti-ship missiles, was kind of what he puts out there. And since it's right at the end of the article, it's only like a paragraph, he doesn't expand on that. I can't comment on it strongly. I'm a World War II interwar guy, but does that sit remotely right with you, or?
You know, I mean, the short answer is that, you know, then you start digging into the debates, which always begin, what would happen if you shot USS Missouri with the Harpoon missile? And, you know, that has begat a billion blog posts. You know, the short answer being that, you know, USS Missouri would do a lot better against an anti-ship missile than, say, a Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. But the Harpoon missile would also blow all the sensors off of any battleship it hit, no matter how armored it is, right? But that's actually something that comes much later. So it comes much well after everybody decides to stop building battleships. I mean, it really is the carrier example that tends to, the carrier displacement that tends to undermine the battleship. Anyway, so let's bounce then to, so you are my Twitter go-to guy, and thank you for being that. Whenever anybody asks me what the latest best work about some aspect of the Pacific War is. So just to sort of as a treat for the listeners at the end, what would you say is sort of the most interesting and exciting work, survey work, or even campaign-specific work that's coming out about the Pacific War in the last few years or that we are looking forward to right now?
Yeah, so there's it's an exciting field to kind of observe. There's been so much coming out about so many different things. For me, some of the most exciting stuff for me is the dawn of, I mean, pretty much three trilogies from three different authors about the Asia-Pacific War, either in its entirety or focused on maybe a particular element. So there's Ian W. Toll's what does he call it? I think it's a Pacific War trilogy. And he's got two of those out. The third one is due, or supposed to come out this year. I know it was delayed. I don't know when it's going to appear. But that one is really excellent. It focuses predominantly on the war at sea and in the air and in the Pacific specifically. That one is very, very good. Then there is another trilogy by Peter Harmsen. That, and he's two volumes into that one as well, with a third one to come at some point. And he's covering the war from pretty much 1931, so the Japanese invasion of Manchuria, to 1945. I can't comment super in detail on that one. I haven't read it yet, but I own them. And I've read Peter Harmsen's other work, and it's very good. And then the third one that I'm personally I'm most excited about is Richard Frank, who's done... I mean, his book on Guadalcanal campaign that he wrote in the early 90s, or came out in the early 90s, is still the authoritative book on the Guadalcanal campaign. And he also wrote Downfall, about the end of the war. He's started his own trilogy called Tower of Skulls. He's got one volume out right now. It goes right up to just before the Battle of the Coral Sea. That one has me super excited just because, I mean, one, it's Richard Frank. He's one of the best scholars working on the Asia-Pacific War. And one of the main points of that book is to write China back into the narrative, as in, it starts in July 1937, And China, he treats the war in China as part of this broader war. It isn't just a little footnote that he puts in a sentence or two every once in a while and then jumps back to Pacific. It's his entire narrative is woven in, and it's not just China either. He's weaving in China and Burma, and he's going to do, you know, New Guinea and the Pacific. So he's doing it all. And that's what makes me so excited, because it's been a long time since we've had people kind of put it out there. Francis Pike, he wrote, tried to write a single volume history that was just a big survey that included all this stuff. The academic reviews I've read for it are very bad. And every time I talk to someone who's read it, that are like, that's a specialist in a particular area, they always say, oh, the book's kind of okay, but in my area, it's not very accurate. And that's never a good sign. You know, if you've got four or five people focusing on different things and none of them ever say that he's on point.
right.
And so that still leaves a one gap, and that's a single volume, one book that you can read. The best one, in my opinion, that we have is still Ronald Spector's Eagle Against the Sun. It is very good, but it came out in the 80s, so it's a little old now. But at least we're getting these trilogies. And that, to me, is the most exciting stuff. As far as some of the most specific stuff, I mean, there's so much. For me, since we started this with China, I can mention a few ones that are related to that. Hans von de Ven just put out a book in 2018 called China at War. And it's just it's actually relatively brief academic kind of political higher level military survey of China at war from, he goes from a little bit before the war against Japan, and then he goes a little bit after the war against Japan. That's a very, very good book. And Peter Harmsen, who I mentioned earlier, he's been doing a trilogy. They're a few years old now, but he's got two very approachable, very readable narrative histories. One on the Battle of Shanghai in 1937, and one on the Battle of Nanjing in 1938. And those two books are superb.
All right. Well, Justin, this has been a delight. And thank you for being with us today. Listeners to Lawyers, Guns, and Money, thank you as always for joining us. And definitely check out some of those wonderful books and check out Justin's wonderful Twitter feed, which is not your name. What is your Twitter feed?
It is the worst Twitter handle ever. I wish I could change it. It's at CBI _PTO_history.
Okay. All right. So check it out, everyone. And thank you so much.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,